Just in time for the holiday season, comic Richard Lewis has a memoir about depression and how he gave up drinking and other addictions and overcame at least a couple of his many dysfunctions. The memoir is called The Other Great Depression. Lewis has built his stand-up career on talking about his problems, but in his memoir, he's more interested in trying to be honest than in going for laughs. Lewis has been featured in several films, including Robin Hood, Men in Tights, and Drunks. He starred opposite Jamie Lee Curtis in the sitcom Anything But Love, and he plays himself on Curb Your Enthusiasm, the new HBO series created by and starring Larry David, the co-creator of Seinfeld. Now, you know, in your comedy act, some of the things you've always traded on are your neurosis, your hypochondria, the rashes you'd get, how depressed you were.
It's a little cold in the studio, too, I might add. Getting
exactly.
A little bit of a chill.
So what was it like, you know, talking about your neurosis and your hypochondria, knowing that you had a really serious problem that wasn't imagined, it wasn't hypochondria, it was your drinking?
Well, I'll tell you, here's the thing. First of all, you know, for the vast majority of my career, I wasn't an alcoholic. And when I was an alcoholic, I quit stand-up because I didn't, you know, I loved the craft so much. That I didn't want to, like, you know, didn't want to be found out. And then when I went back on stage, like I said, I tried my best to be as sober as I possibly could be when I was, you know, doing my craft. But it was, you know, after hours. You know, I did most of the damage alone or, you know, socializing. And, of course, you know, toward the end, you know, when you really can't control how many drinks you have if you're an alcoholic, you know, you'll do it at places where you certainly don't want to look like a fool, like, you know, at screenings and, you know, when there's like, you know, 120 power brokers from town. And I, you know, that's happened from time to time.
Did you ever incorporate drinking into your stand-up routine? I don't mean drinking during the routine. I mean talking about it.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I, well, certainly, ever since I got sober, it was, I slowly but surely talked about, you know, the disease of alcoholism. I remember I did a special back in 96 called the Magical Misery Tour. Well, that was the tour, but the special was the Magical Misery Concert. And I, as a throwaway, because I was still a little nervous about it, I said that I took some time off and I watched the Recovery Channel. Ironically, there is a Recovery Channel now. But certainly in the last 2-3 years, you know, I ad-lib a lot on stage. I carry around in my head about 6 or 7 or 8 hours of new material. And a lot of that is about recovery, and it is about alcoholism and drug abuse. And with great pride now, I say it, as happy as I am writing about it in my book, I am also on stage, and it gives me great pleasure when I would notice an audience member perhaps sort of elbow their significant other and go, you see, he can talk about it, and he's healthy now, and, you know, what about you? I mean, I really see that and sometimes in audience's eyes, you know, and it's it brings me a lot of pleasure.
Richard Lewis is my guest. He's a comic and actor who's just written a memoir about overcoming alcoholism and several other problems.
Thousand.
And dysfunctions.
Yeah.
Yes, addictions, dysfunctions, etc. It's called The Other Great Depression. You know, unfortunately, the language of recovery has become in some circles such a cliched language,
mm-hmm.
The way a lot of things become when they're used and overused a lot. So what's it been like for you as somebody who uses language really well as a comic to try to find a language to discuss something that has become, as important as it is, something of a cliché? It's in a way particularly clichéd for people who are performers and in show business. There are so many people in show business who've had problems with drugs and alcohol. We've heard many of their stories. And so you must have had this fear of speaking really from your heart and having it be heard as a cliché.
Well, you know, that's a very good point. That's why I don't really talk, you know, try not to use the jargon too much because, you know, here, like, for example, this is something that I've heard a lot early on, and this is precisely what you're talking about, that alcoholism is a very selfish disease. But that's a very important thing for people to realize, because when you are drunk and not in recovery, all you really do care about is chasing that high and that rush, and consequently, you forget about people. You forget about a quality life. But when you do decide that life is precious enough and you have to just give up drinking or drugs, then you have to become selfish and only think of yourself and realize that nothing is more important than not drinking, assuming you're an alcoholic. And that's how I live my life now. I let nothing else take precedent over not drinking. You know, then I let everything else, you know, just, you know, fall into place, because I'll never forget, you know, the dark days.
You know, you write a little bit about your parents in your new book, and you say that when you told your mother that you knew you were an alcoholic, mm-hmm. which is a really good sign that you could accept the fact that you were and therefore make a change.
Right.
Her reaction was not the reaction you wanted her to have. What was her reaction?
Well, you know, my mom passed away this year, and my dad passed away when I was, you know, even back way early, you know, back in 1971. And so it was very difficult to write about them. But my mom's reaction was, unfortunately, one of embarrassment. And, you know, and I understand that. But, you know, I think that I was, unfortunately, to her, you know, she was stuck in time where, you know, a child is like more of a reflection of who she is than who, you know, my authentic self was. And, you know, and I was authentically, you know, a successful comedian and also authentically a successful drunk, you know. So, but at that point when I told her, a successful recovering alcoholic. So I just think she was embarrassed, you know. I think there was a part of her way down deep buried that she was proud that I wasn't drinking anymore. But I think she couldn't, you know, shout to the rafters, my son's proudly a recovering alcoholic. I just think it's something that, you know, is so ingrained in her that it was, you know, that it was a little too late in her life to change.
Was she able to accept it when you did comedy about your parents?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, my mother had a great sense of humor, and I'm not mean-spirited. I can really say that. And my comedy, when I talk about other people, it's, you know, the craft of comedy is, you know, hyperbole certainly is a big part of it. And I would exaggerate, but always the truth. And she would be the first to admit, at least privately, that she would do that. You know, I mean, I remember a joke I wrote like 30 years ago, and I used this because it was very economical, and I'm sort of proud of the joke because it was a good joke. It was about how bored I would be driving across country with my family and how unspontaneous they would be and how it would drive me crazy. And I embellished it. We never did drive across country, but I had us backing out of our driveway from our hometown in Englewood, New Jersey, driving to San Francisco, and her jiggling something in her hand. I said, "Mother, what is that? What are you doing? You're making me crazy." And she says, "I have the tolls ready for the Golden Gate Bridge." And that to me was, you know, would have basically, and the audiences always screamed at that because, you know, I had to set it up properly, but that was like, you drive with this family for 3,300 miles, you know, that's where it was at. And when I would say something that would really hit home, she would never get angry. In fact, she would sometimes call me at the hotel in New York and say, "Don't forget to mock me tonight on Letterman." You know what I mean? So I think she had a love-hate thing with it, you know?
Yeah, when you talk about your neurosis, I can relate to some of that and say, yeah, no, that's really funny, and maybe I'll feel a little bit better about myself. So are you going to feel better about yourself if I laugh at your jokes about
Absolutely.
Your neuroses?
I really do feel validated, you know, that I'm not alone. I do. There's no question I feel less alone. I mean, there's nothing worse when I try to, you know, have a riff on stage about a problem that's making me depressed, and I'm looking at an audience, be it 300 or 3,000, and there's silence. I'm saying, wow. I mean, there's a thin line between narcissism and entertainment, and that's pure narcissism, you know. And you really try to, my goal is to entertain people, but if I can entertain them and get laughs to boot and applause about problems that I'm having, it only means, like what you just said, that, you know, they can relate, and that's my goal.
Well, the last thing you want to do is to share your problems on stage in a way that you think is really funny. And instead of people laughing, they feel sorry for you. Has that ever happened to you?
Yes. Once I said, I'm not a complainer, and 3,000 people moaned. if there was a trap door in that concert hall, I would have gone down it. I really had to explain to them. They really didn't understand. It became like a lecture for about 10 minutes. I used this metaphor back in the early 70s, and I didn't intentionally mean it as a hook, but it became one, and I had to stop it. It was a third-person thing, things from hell, like a date from hell, or, my mother from hell, boss from hell, you name it. And it was basically to say that I'm a survivor, and that these people or these things were driving me crazy. And, I ultimately had to stop saying, boy, did I have an evening from hell, because, first it was used all the time. It was used in advertisements. It was used in movie promos, and other comics were using it. And I sort of felt like I was ripping myself off at that point.
Your comedy has always been about, yourself and neurosis, right, and hypochondria, et cetera. How did you know when you started in comedy that you were going to be your subject matter and that your insecurities were going to be what your comedy was about?
Well, when I started out in like 71, a lot of comedy was, observational comedy. And, one of the reasons I went on stage is because I felt, very alienated. I didn't get the kind of nurturing that I felt. I just didn't feel nurtured and appreciated as much as probably I wanted to. So I needed the adulation from strangers, really, from audiences. And when I was starting to, I started writing jokes before I went on stage for, as they say, these Catskill comedians and Borschtbelt comedians. And they were rejecting most of the good stuff. And most of the good stuff was my real feelings about myself. And that was a real sign that, I had to go on stage and do these jokes rather than throw them out. And they were about me. And plus, I felt so judged growing up that I didn't really like to get on stage and tell audiences, did you ever notice this? Did you ever notice when you do that, that you feel this way? That was the last thing I wanted to do. What I wanted to do was talk about how I was feeling and pray to God that it was relatable and that people laughed. And, three decades later, they still are mostly. So I guess I struck a nerve.
One last question. Have you had any new rashes lately?
I will probably get one when I leave the studio worrying about how I did with you.
Fair enough.
But I'll break out in NPR. I promise you that on my thigh.
Okay. Richard Lewis, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Richard Lewis has a new memoir called The Other Great Depression. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan recommends political thrillers for holiday reading and gift giving. This is Fresh Air.